Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey everyone, welcome to the weekend edition of the KE Report. Corey and Chad here, your hosts for this weekend show. First half of the show, we're going to be talking kind of big picture markets, bit of a rotation trade that we continue to see. Also mix in the volatility in the metals and this kind of range-bound nature that we are in. Back half of the show, a lot more focus on the precious metals and the underlying equities and any opportunities that we are seeing there. To kick off this show, we're chatting with Mike Larson. Mike is the editor-in-chief at Money Show. We're actually going to be at a Money Show conference February 22nd to 25th, coming up very soon in Las Vegas at the Paris Hotel. I'm going to post a couple links for you to get some more information on that conference. And last minute, if you want to join us there, or if you're already planning on being at that conference, be sure to reach out to Shad and I. We're going to be on the conference floor for all 3 days. Happy to meet up with every one of you. Mike, let's start off with kind of big picture markets. So much focus, as always, is on the tech stocks, mostly these AI stocks, and a bit of a fade in this whole AI trade. CapEx is not being rewarded anywhere near it was in the last couple of years. It's actually being punished more, and we're starting to hear about AI disrupting some other tech industries like software, and then halfway through this last week, also crept into the financial sector too. So, Mike, what's your takeaway from what is the dominant driver of these markets, the tech and AI trade, having a bit of a shift to a bit more negative now?
Yeah, thanks for having me on. You know, it's funny to talk about how interesting the year is when we're literally only midway through February at this point, or almost midway through February at this point. But we've seen a lot of crazy action in just the first few weeks of 26. You know, when it comes specifically to tech and AI, you're absolutely right. There's been a rotation in the stock market. Behind the scenes, we've seen it consistently where you have money that's sort of rotated out of just the pure, you know, AI information technology sector into sectors like energy, materials, consumer staples, transports. You've seen sort of money rotating into real economy type names, I guess you could call them, and some of the sectors that hadn't performed well previously, like energy. So that's been one part of this. Now, another part has just been the announcement, the size of the investments, the size of the CapEx spending numbers that have been coming out in these earnings reports lately and from big tech have been astronomical. I mean, you're hundreds of billions of dollars, you know, from companies like Microsoft, Oracle, Google, or Alphabet, whatever, and so on, to the point where, you know, analysts expect $130 billion and the number is $190 billion, or, you know, they're looking for $110, it's $190. I mean, you know, we're not talking about missing the targets or expectations by a couple billion bucks. We're talking about tens or even hundreds of billions of dollars cumulatively that these companies are saying they're going to spend to build out the AI infrastructure, the data centers, everything else, you know, train the models and the equipment and software that goes into doing so. At some point, the market, the investors in the sector are saying how much is too much. And I think you've started to see the impact from that. You've started to see the fallout from that in a couple of names. You know, and that's been part of this. And then on the flip side is the AI disruption trade. It's you can't seem to go a day or a week here without some kind of AI announcement disrupting traditional parts of the market, whether it's financials or software and so on. You know, I can't say I invented the term, but the SaaS apocalypse is a great term for what happened to the software sector. All these names, the Salesforces and the Adobes and the sort of big software names, if you will, their software as a service business model relies on continually upgrading software across enterprise licenses by sending out updates remotely. It's a high margin business where you get a lot of consistent revenue and earnings over long periods of time from big corporations that have billions of dollars to spend. And now you've got, you know, AI providers coming out and saying, well, you know, do you really need that $10 billion contract? We can just give you an AI tool that's going to cost you, you know, $30 a license or whatever, and you can do some of this stuff yourself. So that really disrupted the software sector. And then the other day, earlier this week, you had some company that, you know, a small tech startup say, you know what, we've got a tax planning, financial planning, AI-based tool. So all, you know, big finance out there, you're not going to need those those legions of thousands and thousands of financial advisors and planners and everything that you've spent all this money hiring and all the, attracting all these clients. You can just do it with a $100 a month AI product. So what happens? Companies like LPL Financial and Charles Schwab and Raymond James. I mean, some of these stocks had their worst day earlier this week since the COVID pandemic broke out when markets were crashing. So, the magnitude of these moves that you're seeing off of announcements and news that frankly shouldn't be that big of a deal, and especially in the case of AI disruption, is going to take years and years to replace the current way of doing business. And in some highly regulated industries may not even be able to do that because you still need to make sure that whatever answers and whatever guidance you're getting from your AI system is actually, legally accurate and financially accurate, or you're going to get sued every which way till Sunday. So it's remarkable to see that kind of activity. But I think the broader story outside of those individual disruptions is just the rotational trade, out of just big tech into more sort of economically sensitive sectors like materials, like energy, and out of US markets and into foreign markets. I mean, you look, 2025, basically almost every major, developed foreign market and emerging foreign market outperformed the US, and not by a small amount. Even this year, you're seeing a similar trend, where you've got markets in Japan and South Korea and Europe and so on that are really pummeling the S&P. So it's not a situation where just sticking with what worked a couple years ago and having all your eggs in that one basket is working for you in 2026. And frankly, it didn't really work for you in 2025 either.
Well, Mike, a lot of different themes to pull on there, from the rotation trade to the disruption trade. It's interesting to see the effects of AI and how everybody now thinks they can write their own software and do their own financials. So it is disruptive, but it does wreak a little bit of the DeepSeek moment where people freaked out and had a knee-jerk reaction to one news release that the Chinese program could disrupt all AI. And then people settled back into, hey, maybe we got a little ahead of ourselves. So we'll see how things develop in the disruption trade. On the rotation trade, though, do you think it's also similar to a rotation from growth into value? You mentioned consumer staples and materials and energy, and a lot of people are looking for something real or tangible. So do you think it's that move into value from a market that was obsessed with growth?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely part of it. I mean, you've really got your finger on part of the trend, or one of the sort of sub trends or whatever, that's driving this action. I mean, I think, in a situation where the economic numbers are decent enough, where you've got some support, especially in terms of foreign stimulus in many other parts of the world, all this new spending that wasn't there in the past, people are looking for ways to play some of these new trends that have been newer stories for a new year. I mean, let's be honest, everybody kind of kicks off a new year looking for new things to do, new ways to profit in their portfolio. So yeah, some of it's the rotation from growth to value, some of it's the rotation from domestic to international, some of it's the rotation from, all tech to materials and industrials and transports that have more economic sensitivity. So you have a little bit of everything going on there. And you throw in the backdrop a Fed that, while it's kind of sitting on its hands for now, and especially in the wake of the latest jobs numbers, which look decent, if not spectacular, but definitely beat expectations to the upside, you get a Fed that's not going to do anything for a little while, but is probably looking at maybe another cut or two down the road in 2026. So that's also supportive of things like small caps. So a little bit of everything going on there, but it boils down to the theme of looking for new winners in a new year and some new trends, that you can capitalize on. And it doesn't mean that the AI trade is dead forever, or that companies like Microsoft or Oracle or whatever are going to, fall apart like all the dot-coms did back in the old days. They're different companies in a different era. But it does mean that, if money is going to rotate out of those sectors, they may be dead money for a while other stocks and other sectors pick up the baton.
So, Mike, when you consider that, yes, international markets did far better than US markets, especially when you factor in the currency and the US dollar going down last year, and the data out of the US is still okay. It has been okay. As much as people are waiting for that recession, US markets were just at all-time highs, but again, they're underperforming. Is this a healthy market, or is this a market that seems to be kind of rising with all the other markets, but there are some structural issues?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a market that, especially in the first half of the year, is going to be a lot choppier than we got used to. I mean, I remember speaking at our events, a couple of things we had late in 2025, and the first couple of weeks here, where I basically said we're not going to be in kind of this up and to the right type environment. I think there's a lot of political questions. You know, what's going to happen with the midterm elections? There's a lot of geopolitical questions. What's going to happen with, you know, China and Taiwan, and you know, the never-ending situation in Ukraine with Russia. You've got, you know, monetary policy questions. The Fed's going to be sitting on its hands probably for at least the first quarter, if not the first half of the year. So you're not going to have, you know, a steady stream of rate cuts helping things out. And then you are going to have questions about, you know, the AI versus other sectors. Have things gotten too hot to handle? So all of that is sort of swirling around out there, and at this point in time, and it really has been since the start of the year, and I think it's probably going to continue to do so again for at least the rest of this quarter and maybe the entire first half. So, you know, I think that you shouldn't expect as an investor just a powerful, just steady bull run here in the first half of the year, at least. Possibly, if you listen to some people like Jeff Hirsch, you know, obviously speaks at our money show events, and he's looked in sort of the seasonality and some other issues. He thinks maybe once you get past the midterms, you have a nice run into year end. But a lot of the people that I speak to, that I listen to at our conferences, are definitely more cautious about the front end of this year at the very least.
Well, and we have to remind people that we're coming off of two really great years back to back, 2023, 2024, 2025, really 3 years back to back of solid growth. So for there to be a more of a sideways year or more of a choppy year kind of makes sense. Well,
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, again, the S&P was up 16% last year. It was up 24%, give or take, for 2 years prior to that. So, I mean, that's a heck of a run, 3 years, you know, over a course or span of 3 years. So, you know, we all like to be greedy. We wouldn't be involved in the markets if we weren't. But at some case, you're going to need to spend some time digesting moves like that.
well, speaking of chop and digesting moves, let's shift over to the precious metals, Mike, because wow, what a crazy start to 2026 for gold and especially for silver. But we even saw it in platinum, we saw it in palladium, we saw it in copper, really the metals complex as a whole. But if we just isolate it to the precious metals, you know, coming into the year, they already had a great year last year, a banner year, I would say, in 2025. But kicking off January, the moves in silver got up to 121 on the futures market, gold got up to 5,600. Then gold crashed by a range of about $1,200. Silver crashed by a range of about $50. When just last year, at the beginning of the year, silver was only $30. So to see a fall from 121 down to, I think, $64, quite a move. Now things are kind of stabilizing, but very choppy. How are you looking at the precious metals markets here and now?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, holy cow, you know, for a little while there, it looked like precious metals were trading like crypto and Bitcoin used to trade a few years back. And frankly, there's been a lot of volatility there too. I think it's important, you know, when it comes to silver and to a lesser extent gold, to look at the history of this bull run that we've had for the last few years. And frankly, there have been a few, you know, it's easy to forget them now because the numbers overall, as you mentioned, the price of gold, the price of silver were smaller, and some from a percentage terms basis, some of these moves were smaller. But we've had periodic blow-off moves to the upside and sharp reversals several times during this bull run. In the case of silver, you saw it in April of 2025, you saw it again in September, October of 2025. You know, if you go even further back, you can see on the chart, again, when you like exclude the big peak we saw earlier, we saw other freakout moments, even as far back as October, November of 2024, where it was the metals had a big run, a big reversal. People wanted to say, oh, that's the end of the bull market. But what ended up happening is you got 3 or 4 months of sideways chop. Those big blow-offs and reversals helped get the really frothy sentiment out of the market. And then you were able to let the underlying trends that are behind this precious metals bull market reassert themselves, and we started climbing again. Again, the ranges, the price ranges, and the volume involved has gotten bigger with each of these moves, but the pattern has been similar, you know. So I think as long as that's the case, as long as after the big run-up, big reversal, spike low and reversal on the downside, like you mentioned, we got all the way down to $64 in the futures market for silver, you know, as long as we now spend some time just chopping sideways, you know, the swings get smaller, that you don't, you know, have a long-term reversal on the chart. You have more of this, okay, this was an intermediate term top, but now we base build for a while and then move up from there. As long as that pattern holds, then I don't see any reason to kind of abandon the themes that have been working, which is a generally falling dollar, more central bank money into precious metals, more investors looking for, you know, whatever you want to call it, debasement insurance, or, you know, in their currency and their purchasing power and so on. As long as all those things are still in place, and from where I sit, they are, you can still gradually, you know, again, work off some of that euphoria and panic, and then build a base for the next leg up.
Mike, if we're looking forward, What do you think the odds are that silver gets back over 100, or even more importantly, back to 120 by later this year, a couple months, couple quarters, whatever it might be? What's your outlook on that sort of a recovery?
I think it's probably in the cards. I think it, again, I think if you look at just sort of the pattern of the bull market and you look at how things have gone over time, after you flush out some of the sentiment and you build that base for the next leg up, then yeah, I don't see why that couldn't happen. I mean, again, the important thing, to me, it's all about this sort of a pattern analysis. If you want to forget the fundamentals and just kind of put your technical analysis hat on and try and, it's very hard, especially if you're invested in the sector, it's very hard to see a couple hundred dollar swings in gold and think, oh my gosh, what is this metal that I used to hold that was so stable and now it's going up or down $200, $300, $400 sometimes in a day. But on a percentage basis, is it really all that different from what you saw back when the price was in the, around 4,000, or the price was around 3,000, or even the price was around 2,500 not too long ago? It's not. So it's just a matter of kind of keeping the pattern in mind, and don't be wowed or shell-shocked by the fact that the dollar numbers we're talking about are getting higher. Again, could I be wrong? Could that have been the end of the great precious metals bull run, and we're just gonna roll over and fall for the next couple of years? I don't think so, but theoretically, anything's possible. What I'll be watching from a technical standpoint is how the next few weeks plays out, maybe the next month or two. Again, if as long as we see that sort of base building process where we just chop, the ranges get smaller, you don't see another round of liquidation and a stair step lower, then nothing's really changed from a technical standpoint.
Well, and if we shift from the technical standpoint to the macro fundamental standpoint, a lot of people attributed the big crash suddenly that last day of the month to Kevin Warsh being nominated as the new Fed head and what his policy would be as far as being more hawkish. I still can't imagine that the Trump administration placed him in that role if he was going to be super hawkish. But that was the narrative, Mike. And then you still have all the central banks buying globally, and you have a pattern where the physical markets in Asia have been setting the pace more so than the paper markets in the West. So, what do you make of some of the macro themes, just to counterbalance the technical talk? Anything that you see on the horizon disrupting that or accelerating that?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. When you look at, what was, and I always say in quotes, what was the reason why it happened? And you're right. The Warsh announcement, I mean, of the choice that, of the choices that had been floated over the last few months for potential Fed chairs, he's probably the one historically who has been more hawkish. But again, you said it yourself there. I mean, I don't think that the administration would be looking to put somebody in that's going to turn around and put on a big hawk suit and start hiking rates or not be open to the idea of cutting rates further. Theoretically, if the Fed's independent, okay, whatever. But I mean, let's be honest, there's a lot of pushback against that idea, and there's a lot of people that question whether the Fed was truly independent even under other administrations. So long story short, I don't think the Warsh nomination is ushering in an era of tight money on the monetary side, nor do I think we're looking at an environment of fiscal discipline on the fiscal side under this administration, which is looking to spend and do what borrow and spend in a lot of different ways, just like the Democrats did when they were in power. So yeah, I don't think that the trajectory of the U.S. currency, the trajectory of U.S. monetary policy, the trajectory of U.S. fiscal policy, any of that stuff has really changed if I put my long-term investor hat on. And as long as that's the case, again, you can make a very strong argument, and I would, that you continue to want to be a precious metals bull for the foreseeable future and probably the long-term future.
How does that carry over to all the other markets too? Because usually when we do see easier fiscal policy, people have more money hits the markets broadly. So is this a general kind of melt up that we could continue to see?
I don't know if I would go so far as to say a melt up, but I think it's not surprising to see, the Dow at 50,000. I mean, we got Dow 50K hats on here, and you're seeing rotation into more economically sensitive sectors outside of tech, the transports, the industrials, materials, and so on. And that's all part of, yes, the sort of Lynn Alden Schwarzer run it hot type scenario. There's no stopping this train, whatever you want to call it, in terms of the fiscal spending and fiscal stimulus. So yeah, I mean, I think it makes a lot of sense to me that you can have a market where a lot of equities, particularly economically sensitive ones, can do well, even as gold and silver are doing well. It's, there's been periods in the past where people were only buying gold and silver when the world was going to heck in a handbasket. It was all just sort of like an insurance trade, or this is the only thing that can go up when stocks crash. But in this environment, and really for quite some time, it's been more of a rising in tandem, equities plus commodities plus metals. because they're all deriving some of their momentum from some of the same underlying things, which is fiscal and monetary policy being more stimulative.
Well, Mike, in light of these different sectors, whether it's the general markets or commodities, you mentioned that cryptocurrencies have been quite volatile, and man, they sure have. I don't know if some of the speakers there at the show have addressed this, but what is the take from some of the speakers at the Money Show or from some of the people you follow on what's happening in the cryptoverse? Because it had had a pretty great move up until, I guess, October of last year, and since then it's kind of fallen out of bed, which is not like the S&P going to 7,000 or the Dow going to 50,000 or gold and silver breaking new highs. What happened to cryptos?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, I always say when the conversation starts veering towards crypto, I'm certainly not a specialist, but we do have specialists that'll be there in Vegas, and I personally am interested in getting more of their take, as I'm sure many of the attendees will be as well. It has tended to break that correlation with equities. We had the and precious metals. We had them all rallying, and I think that part of it. I mean, let's be honest. I think that the part of it is that. Bitcoin is going to be more correlated or tend to trade more with the tech universe and the Nasdaq and so on than it is with the Dow. So I think, the QQQ is going nowhere since October with Bitcoin declining and money rotating into Dow and industrial smokestack type names is all part of that same rotation, all part of that same, the tech verse, if you want to call it, underperforming and Bitcoin being sort of swept up in that. So I think if I had to sort of try and explain a move, it would be that, you're seeing the fact that Bitcoin has tended to trade more with tech and that sector of the market versus equities overall, including things like Dow stocks and even non-tech S&P.
So is this broadly a time, Mike, where diversification is key because we're seeing a bit of a divergence, not so much leadership that we saw the last few years? Or are you seeing opportunities in some of these lagging sectors, at least recently, in terms of buying opportunities and going heavily, more heavily into those?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, again, as an investor, and this is a theme that showed up in our top picks report from some of our speakers or people that contributed to that. It's, sort of my personal opinion, and it's also what we've had and a couple of people that have come on the podcast, is that, you have to broaden your horizons beyond big tech. It's always going to be the sexiest story. It's always going to have that sort of, flashiness to it, and people that really are true believers, they'll hold on to their tech through come hell or high water and what have you. And it's fine. I don't think that those stocks all have to fall out of bed and you have to, sell all your tech and so on. But you got to be thinking about other ways, other to play where the strength is going to be moving forward and where really it has been for a little while now. And that's in some of those sectors that haven't done well in the past. That is in the financials, the materials, and from a cap standpoint, the smaller cap type stocks, the SMID names, if you want to use the Wall Street jargon. But yeah, I mean, that's, it's important, I think, as an investor to realize that just like what happened with precious metals, which nobody really wanted to talk about, and now look what happened. People missed out on the best year since 1979 if they weren't following that space. Pay attention, look at what else is out there and don't just get caught up in things that you're going to be fed on the social media platforms and fed on the media because it's exciting to talk about. I like excitement as much as the next guy, but when it comes to my portfolio, I like making money even more. And I want to be in some of these other groups that are going to probably offer a better chance to make more money this year than, when we had a couple years back and it was all big tech all the time.
All right. Good points, Mike. Always great chatting with you and really looking forward to hanging out with you and the rest of the Money Show team in Las Vegas again, February 22nd to 25th. I will post those links in the show notes. So please, everyone, click those links, join us in Vegas, and tell Shad and I that you'll be there so that we can all meet up. Mike, thank you again for your time on this weekend show, and see you soon in Vegas.
You got it. Looking forward to it.
Al Corlin's firm, AB Corlin and Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout.